Blog Talk Radio.
3, 2, 1. A new assortment of Mythbusters, Mythbusters Jr., get down to busting January 2nd in prime time on the Science Channel. Executive producer Wyatt Channel, that's right, Channel, joins me next. Someone's always busting with thoughts on sports TV and TV in general will be along next half hour. I'm talking about Queen's Chronicle columnist Lloyd Carroll. And also ahead, our new, yes, new, classic trivia question winner. Hello, everyone. I'm Simon Applebaum. Simon casting live from New York on Blog Talk Radio and Spreaker and present on the iHeartRadio Podcast Network. This just in, tomorrow will be televised. Brought to you by Audible.com, the leading provider of spoken audio entertainment information that will transform the way you hear the world. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day trial at audibletrial.com/televised. And from now until the end of the holiday season, you can make that 3 audiobooks for the trial of one. More details later in the program. Happy to have you with us a little earlier than normal on this Wednesday edition of the program All About Television. 33 degrees, the top of the hour here in New Haven, New York. Pair of wonderful guests for you over the next hour, and we invite you to be in the conversation. It's that simple. All you have to do is pick up the phone, raise your voice, and use this number, 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. The number's good anyway. You're captured across the country, around the globe. You're on Blog Talk Radio and Spreaker. Our chat room is open for business as well. It's waiting for you. It's SimonApple04 by name, and you will find us at our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. And don't forget, you can connect others while the program is on the air by using Facebook Timeline. Click on the Facebook icon on your Blog Talk screen, following instructions, and other people can be live with you. And live with us right now from Silver Spring, Maryland, outside Washington, D.C., executive producer for Mythbusters Jr., Wyatt Channel. Wyatt, happy holidays. Welcome in.
Hey, happy holidays to you. Thanks so much for having me. I'm always happy to talk Mythbusters.
It is a pleasure. And what have Mythbusters come back this time in junior form?
You know, we're all just so excited about it, right? It's been a little while. It's so great to have Adam Savage back. It's great to have these kids who are sort of brilliant little geniuses. And it's great to be doing all the sort of things that people have associated with the show forever, big explosions and duct tape stunts and all kinds of fun things.
What do you think made Mythbusters such a winning show for so many years on Discovery Channel? And was there all along, when the original show with Adam and crew was on, was there always talk about let's make an adaptation just for the small fry, for the teens, the tweens, the youngsters who also are interested in busting a few myths of their own?
Yes. Yeah, so, when you go back to the original Mythbusters, and I think it started in something like 2003, you just see a couple of guys who are like everybody else, right? I mean, they're really smart people, but they found these questions and had this sort of innate curiosity, and they're just having fun, right? You watch them, and everything they do, you know, even the stuff that's occasionally hard or challenging, is fun. They're blowing up cars. They're sort of asking the questions that you probably ask yourself, and I think that's the type of sort of innate curiosity that just really translates well for everyone. And in terms of Mythbusters Jr., it's a slightly newer idea, but I think, you know, in particular, as we've all gotten older, there's sort of this thought of, well, who is the next generation, right? I mean, it's an interesting thing to sort of think about who's going to be following in the footsteps of that sort of previous generation of television. And, you know, what better way to do that than to find kids who are already capable of doing this sort of really deep, fun, buildy science stuff.
How did you find these kids? These are all under the age of 16. They come from all over the country, including, I'm happy to say, Elijah, who happens to come from right here in Brooklyn, New York, where we originated our show. How long did it take to find these Mythbusters?
So I should give a very big shout out to the production company that did a lot of the Beyond Productions out of Australia, who did a lot of the sort of early casting work for us. You know, we knew we wanted to find a group of kids with sort of a diverse skill set. Because they're so young, they don't often have time to really develop a bunch of different skills. So we needed, you know, we have Jesse who sort of welds and fabricates well. We have Allie who's sort of starts as an inventor. You know, we have Cannon, who is probably about 4 years away from driving, but is a college sophomore who handles a lot of sort of the math and calculations, that type of stuff. So it was a process. They had a bunch of options for us, and we sort of tried to pick who we thought would go really well together, as sort of well as cover these sort of building skill set needs that we had, because you can't do Mythbusters if you can't have someone who can weld.
What about these individual kids really stood out for you as, like, these are, like, the perfect people to be the next generation of Mythbusters, the next generation to try these, prove that these experiments are, or that the outcome of these experiments are either myth or actually real?
I think there were a bunch of small moments, right? I mean, I will confess I don't have kids, and this is actually the first show I've done working directly with them. But what you realize is that even with as young as they are, they really are their own people. And as you sort of get into this process, because it really is a build show, when you watch these kids sort of start coming up with their own solutions to these problems, some of which are really brilliant and very workable, you sort of realize that, these are really the right kids to be doing what they're doing.
We're talking with Wyatt Channel. He is the executive producer of Mythbusters Jr. It's the new version of Mythbusters, you might say second generation, version 2.0, and it comes on Science Channel January 2nd, 9 p.m. Eastern and Pacific time. Wyatt joins us live from Silver Spring, Maryland, and outside the nation's capital, Washington, D.C., this half hour on Marvy Televised. I'm in with you live from New York. We're 3 hours earlier than normal. We know we usually come your way Mondays and Fridays, 3 p.m. Eastern Pacific, on Blog Talk Radio and Spreaker. But we're doing this a little earlier than normal on this Wednesday because later on today I'm going to be going to Harlem for a very special event that I hope will be leading to something I can tell you about before we wrap up 2018 on a future episode of this program. So if you have a question or comment for Wyatt, put the call in, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. We have one more episode coming your way this week at our regular time period. That's Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern Pacific. And we will kick it off with a look at the brand-new Amazon version of one of the great classic novels of all time. It's been adapted in film and TV all over the place for the decades. Vanity Fair, award-winning British director James Strong will be our lead guest. And then, what's the TV technology scene look like going into 2019, including CES next month in Las Vegas? We'll talk to Engadget managing editor Dina Wallman, and the review editor Cheyenne Lowe. And then we have a special pre-Christmas treat for you. We will preview A&E's first big event of 2019, the three-night Surviving R. Kelly. We'll go live to Detroit and speak with executive producer, famed filmmaker Dream Hampton. That is all coming up Friday, 90th edition, pre-Christmas edition of Tomorrow We Televise for 2018. That's this Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern Pacific, right here on our program. Once you got the kids together, how long did it take for them to come up with the different myths that they bust?
So that's always a process. It's, we got the kids together a little bit in advance and really let them interact a little bit so they could get used to being around each other, as well as, you know, there are always adults on the set as well, and Adam too, of course. The contribution sort of started immediately. I think there's a little bit of a learning curve for everyone. But it makes you feel good. If you are concerned about the current state of the world, these really are the kids who are going to be fixing it up for us over the next 20 years or so.
What was it like for Adam to get back into the groove, if you will, of doing Mythbusters?
I don't want to entirely speak for him, but it really looked like he was having a good time. He's sort of such a natural person on camera. That it was just fun because he sort of is a big kid too, right? I mean, that's sort of one of his best qualities, is that innate curiosity and enthusiasm. The scene, he and the kids sort of get together and riff off each other, and, you know, even you'll get a little bit of it on the show, but just playing around as well. You know, it's very much the same big busting and explosions and occasionally dangerous things, but, you know, they had a great time too. So it was a very natural, I think, seamless thing for him.
Incidentally, I definitely want to make sure that we cite and we honor Beyond Productions, which is the folks that came up with MythBusters. They come from Australia. They've done some wonderful work all over the world when it comes to science technology. You probably still remember Beyond Tomorrow, or Beyond, that was their show that was in Australia for many years. Beyond Tomorrow was on here in the United States on Fox, one of their first TV shows back in the mid to late 80s. And they always do a marvelous job. They're one of the very best in terms of TV programming in that specific arena of science and technology. I understand the first episode, you actually bring back a classic situation of the original program, which is the duct tape situation, where you see, can you make a parachute that actually saves lives, drop it from an extreme height, and make it out of duct tape?
Yeah, that's true. We filmed a bunch of them, and this was actually not the first thing we filmed, but once we'd seen it, it was sort of such an obvious decision, because if there's one thing that you think of, or at least that I think of with MythBusters, it's sort of the classic duct tape myths, like the duct tape bridge across the chasm and things like that. So, you know, if you've never wondered, could you make a duct tape parachute, you should absolutely tune in, because the process is fascinating. The results are slightly terrifying. And everyone had a great time. I mean, how can you not have a good time dropping something with a duct tape parachute out of a helicopter over 500 feet, right?
No. And I also understand that on some of the upcoming episodes, you do some very interesting things based on some very popular movies and television shows. I believe there's one stunt that you do that was inspired by the Oscar-winning film Gravity from Alfonso Cuarón, who is now winning rave reviews for his latest movie on Netflix, Roma, which is also being seen in theaters too this holiday season. And you also do one from Breaking Bad, which that comes across as very interesting, one of the great dramas of all of recent years.
Yeah, that's true. You know, I think a lot of us, when we watch movies, we see something and we think, you know, there's a kernel of truth in that, but I don't know if it would actually work. So, you know, if you see Gravity and you see Sandra Bullock using a fire extinguisher in space as a sort of form of propulsion, I mean, you understand how a fire extinguisher works. It pushes you back. So the real question is, would that work? And we found a pretty creative way. I don't want to throw any spoilers out there, I think, doing a really legitimate test to see whether or not that was a viable way of getting from a spacecraft to the space station.
What to you makes the perfect MythBusters situation? Obviously, it's got to be something that is grand, that results in possible explosions or something really spectacular in terms of what you see visually. So it's got to be visual. But I'm curious to get more into the process of how you create these situations. Are there certain things that you look for or certain scientific principles that you try to showcase by doing the situation?
Yeah, you know, and I'll confess, I've only been working on MythBusters properties for a few years, so there is a lot of inbuilt knowledge from people who worked before me. You know, there are a few things we look for. We really try and find myths that we think will end up being either confirmed or denied. We certainly end up with plausible sometimes, but it's not the ideal solution. You know, we really love being as definitive as possible. There is a sort of visual element to it. You know, you've had these same wonderful camera operators now for over a decade who are responsible for all those slow-mo shots you see, which is such a sort of iconic and important part of the show. And I think we look for things that, again, you sort of, there's an innate familiarity to it, right? It's something that you think should work or shouldn't work just based on what you know. It's not about sort of extremely high-tech science or anything like that. It's much more about things that, again, seem commonsensical but may not be.
Now, in addition to Adam Savage returning as both host and along with you an executive producer of the series, you also have two other people who are also involved with these kids in the individual sequences. One is Tamara Robertson, who actually was featured on another MythBusters program, The Search. And then you also have John Marco, who has been very much involved with both TV and film in the air special effects.
Yeah, that's right. We're always happy to have folks back. And, you know, the kids are brilliant, but they also need help building stuff on occasion. And frankly, it's just a large volume of stuff. So Tamara and John came back to really help the kids out. Oftentimes, we'll have two builds per episode. So we'll end up splitting the kids into two groups of three, each of which will have sort of a builder to help them out with things. And it also brings another perspective, right? It's sort of great to watch these kids work together with Tamara and John and sort of find solutions to problems that frankly, I would have no idea how to solve as an otherwise capable adult.
Incidentally, once you and your fellow producers decide to take a situation and tape it or film it, how long does it take to do that, both in terms of setting up the situation somewhere in the East United States or sometimes beyond, and secondly, to actually get it down on tape?
So, another call out for our excellent showrunner, a guy named John Tessier, who did a phenomenal job this season. It depends a little bit. Some builds are a little bit simpler than others, but usually you're looking at about 3 or 4 days per build. But you're also doing, you know, multiple builds per day because there are sort of important rules about how long kids can work and things like that you have to be very sensitive to. You don't want to interrupt their education. But so basically, you know, each of these stories you're looking at was probably shot over the course of a week. And then there's the sort of whole edit and post process, which tends to take a few months.
For all you Mythbusters fans out there who've been waiting for the next generation to finally show up, well, they will, starting January 2nd, 9:30 Pacific Time, with a brand new series, Mythbusters Jr. on The Science Channel. Wyatt Channel, yes, that's his last name, is one of the executive producers of the show. He is with us live from Silver Spring, Maryland, outside Washington, D.C. This half hour on Tomorrow will be televised. Simon Applebaum with you live from New York. Delighted to be with us a little earlier than normal this Wednesday here on Blog Talk Radio and Speaker. If you have a question or a comment for our guest, don't be shy. Pick the phone up. Make your voice go. 646-652-2906. Or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Coming your way, by the way, later this half hour, we will have our brand new classic trivia question winner. We'll tell you who the winner is. We'll tell you what the correct answer is. And yes, we even had someone who was very close in actually becoming a winner today. We'll get to all of that later this half hour. And by the way, next week we'll be with you again on Wednesday and Friday. That'll be our last two episodes of 2018. Coming up on Wednesday, we will feature a co-writer director of the latest installment of the popular Hulu monthly series, Into the Dark, from Jason Blum and his Blumhouse Productions gang. If you think you've seen every kind of story dealing with New Year's, we do you see New Year, New You. Writer-director Sophia Takei will join us as our lead guest. That's 1 week from today, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, exclusively on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Any favorite stunts from this first group of Mythbusters Jr. that you like, that you hope we'll see?
Oh, boy. You know, we bring a lot of experts in. One of the coolest stunts we tried is there's a pretty famous story about Odysseus coming back and shooting an arrow through 12 rings. And it turns out even if you get, like, the world's best archer, that's really tough to do. So we spent a lot of time trying to figure out whether or not that was a confirmed, denied, or plausible. And the results are pretty interesting.
Since a number of these kids have experience inventing things, being at science fairs, studying various unique aspects of science, did any of them come up with a unique situation that you actually put on tape?
Yeah, you know, there were a bunch of unique solutions. I think one of the myths we look at is there's a sort of famous commercial about on Japanese television about sort of a human-sized glue trap. So the kids spent a lot of time trying to figure out if you could make a human-sized glue trap, if you could, how it would work. And the sort of process they went through to put that on air was not only great television, but I think really indicative of how smart and savvy they were as kids.
What kind of outreach is Science Channel doing to make sure that not only people around the country, but also schools around the country tune in and catch what these kids are doing?
So there's a really big marketing push, both through marketing. We have sort of separate social and digital media groups as well. And a shout out as well to Adam's had some of the same people working with him, and he of course has a huge social and digital presence as well. And that's sort of the main push. You'll see a lot of on-air promotion, and Discovery Communications also has a separate group that sort of works doing educational initiatives with schools as well. So hopefully, sort of all of those things will get the word out. Our audience tends to be a little bit older than school age, certainly, but I really think it's a show that everyone will watch, again, as long as you like the original Mythbusters.
Robert, what kind of reaction are you getting from the public about Mythbusters coming back in this way? What kind of excitement are folks bringing you about the fact that one of their favorites is back?
It's been really strong, right? I think it sort of all starts with Adam. If you're like me, and I think a lot of the other people who were fans of the first iteration, you just miss him, right? You miss being able to kind of hang out with him and sort of go on these miniature builds and adventures. So, you know, at least so far, everything we've seen is that people are just happy to have him back. I know we are.
Incidentally, do any of the other original Mythbusters make any cameo or surprise appearances in any of the episodes?
No, not this season. This one was very much the kids and Adam, but I wouldn't rule anything out. It's always great to see those familiar faces.
And while you're waiting for season two to get the go-ahead, are you working on any other projects for Science Channel or other Discovery networks?
Sure, I have a bunch of stuff. BattleBots was mine this year. That was a ton of fun. A great production company, great organization. And I get a lot of our hardcore science, too. We have How the Universe Works coming up really soon in January, I believe, season 7 or 8 of that. They keep me busy.
Let's talk about BattleBots before we go, because we had the executive producers on earlier this year. I know it did very, very well in its return to television. What kind of feedback did you get about BattleBots, and what can we look forward to in the second season?
You know, the feedback was all really positive. I think we tried to put as much bots battling time on screen as possible. I think folks enjoyed that. You know, we're always interested in getting even more bots from around the world, so we have a more diverse sort of bot cast, and I think we're also interested in seeing if we can't get more diverse builds as well. So, you know, it's not a league that's dominated by horizontal and vertical spinners, but really excited. They're great people to work with. And if you can't watch robots fighting each other to the death and smile, I don't know. That's not a world I want to live in.
The robots that were featured in this first time on the Science Channel were incredibly sophisticated. I mean, if you remember way back when BattleBots first appeared on Comedy Central, then I believe in ABC for a season or two. This is like night and day. What you can do with these robots, how the people can control them in that stadium, in that space, really remarkable.
Yeah, and they're terrifying too as well. I mean, I think Tombstone is the one that everybody knows. It sort of looks a bit like a two-wheeled lawnmower with an exposed lawnmower blade, and it's terrifying. Until I went to the live event and they sort of started it up and you could feel the floor vibrating from the amount of power in it, I didn't understand how scary it was. So for folks who are in the California area, if you do have a chance, come down to the live event. It is a lot of fun to see things live. We turned that into the TV show, but again, it's they're both great experiences to have.
And when it comes to near term, great experience to see back on television in a new version is Mythbusters as Mythbusters Jr. Check out the first episode Wednesday, January 2nd, 9 p.m. Eastern and Pacific Time on the Science Channel. Check your locals for where the network is available in the area on cable and satellite. For more details about the program online is www.sciencechannel.com. That's www.sciencechannel.com. Wyatt Channel, yes, that is his last name. Executive producer, Mythbusters Jr., thank you for coming on this midweek to talk about it. All the very best with the series. Hope it has a great, like the original, a wonderful run. It's been a pleasure to have you on. And from all of us at Glossop Radio and Speaker to all of you and the folks at Beyond Production back in Australia, have a wonderful holiday season, a great 2019 ahead.
You too. Thank you so much for having us. We're really excited.
You're welcome, Wyatt. Certainly got that. Take care. All the greatest.
You too. Take care.
Wyatt Chandler, executive producer of MythBusters Jr., joining us live from Silver Spring, Maryland, outside Washington, D.C. In a moment, our new classic trivia question winner and what that winner will get. But first, some words from the fine folks at Audible.com. In case you don't know, there's a holiday drive going on with Audible.com, Amazon division, and it's this. Rather than get one free audiobook for a 3-day trial, you now can get three. One regular and two from the growing catalog of Audible Originals. That's original radio and audio productions. Everything from one woman, one man performances, off-Broadway and Broadway productions, and original scripted and unscripted material made especially for Audible.com. And don't forget, Audible.com is the leading provider of spoken digital audio entertainment, information, and most certainly, inspiration. Over 100,000 titles to choose from. And you listen to them on any device, including wherever you are hearing us on right now at Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker, iHeartRadio. Remember, if you sign up at audibletrial.com/televised, you get not one, not two, but three free audiobooks and that 1 month trial plus great customer service from the fine folks at Amazon.com. So how about this? Audible can transform the way you or someone you want to give a gift to this holiday season can change the world. So remember, if you want to hear the world a totally different way, go to audibletrial.com/televised. You or someone you know will be very happy you did. So check this holiday offer out. Won't last long. So remember, audibletrial.com/televised. Not one, not two, but three free audiobooks and a 1 month trial. And I promise you, it will be worth your hearing. And now it's time for our classic trivia segment, and I'm happy to say that for the first time in about 2 months, we have a classic trivia question winner. And that winner is Jim Tsui from Laguna Hills, California. The question that we posed originally on Monday's episode, on what TV series did Art Carney play Santa Claus? The answer, The Twilight Zone, in an episode that premiered nearly 60 years ago. The actual date was December 23rd, 1960. That's right, 2 days before Christmas, 1 day before Christmas Eve. The play was called The Night of the Meek, and it starred Art Carney playing a very boozy Santa Claus who finds out that he can really make a difference with people thanks to a magic bag. Carney delivered a marvelous performance. It was written by Rod Serling, directed by Jack Smite, and probably you'll be able to see it during the new Twilight Zone Marathon coming up New Year's Eve, New Year's Day period on Sci-Fi. So once again, the answer is The Night of the Meek on The Twilight Zone. And we congratulate Jim Tsui from Laguna Hills, California. And Jared, coming your way will be DVDs of the recent National Geographic special Inside North Korea's Dynasty and Cesar Millan, Love My Pitfall. Plus, we'll get you The Genius Box, the book by the best-selling author and former TWBT guest, David Tice. It's all coming your way. Also, I want to acknowledge Means Johnson III, who came very, very close to winning. He gave me a Facebook posting suggesting The Honeymooners was the episode where Art Carney played Santa Claus. That's not the case. And he came so close to becoming the winner. But Jim got in there first. So, Jim, congratulations. Means, thanks for playing. And the prizes are coming your way. And, by the way, Jim is our last Classic Trivia Question winner of 2018. So I want to take a moment to congratulate all the winners of our Classic Trivia segment this year. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And we will give our trivia segment a rest for the rest of the year. We'll bring it back on Monday, January 7th, when we'll have a brand new question. And if you know the answer when we pose it, email me, simonapple04@yahoo.com. It's simonapple04@yahoo.com. Don't forget to enclose your name and your full name and address. And if you miss the question, once we present it, we'll post it the next day on Facebook and on Twitter at UBC Simon TWBT. UBC Simon TWBT. Remember, in order to win, just like Jim Tsui did in Laguna Hills, California, you've got to be in. So do so, and all the very best. When we come back, Lloyd Carroll. You never know what he's going to say about the world of sports and media. He'll say it to us as we pause at the bottom of the hour for web identification. This is www.blogtalkradio and www.speaker.com, together reaching over 30 million listeners around the world every month and growing. On Blog Talk Radio, it's your home for conscious creation. Check out Dee Wallace. That's right, the Dee Wallace from E.T. She's got a wonderful radio show on BTR, and you can catch it Sunday at noon, Eastern Time, 9 a.m. Pacific, exclusively on Blog Talk Radio. Remember, best BTR available 24/7 at YouTube.com. Welcome back to the second half of this special midweek edition of Tomorrow Be Televised on pre-Christmas week 2018. Simon Appleband with you live from New York. We have another fun guest coming your way this half hour, and we invite you to be part of the program. All it takes, awaiting from you. So call in 646-652-2906 or chat room in at SimonApple04 that you find on the homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. Our second guest today is someone we haven't had on this program in quite some time, but I'll tell you, when it comes to talking about sports television, and TV, he is never, repeat, never at a loss for words. And like I said in the title, he's always busting with thoughts. Joining me here in New York, the popular columnist of the Queens Chronicle, Lloyd Carroll. Hello, Lloyd.
Hey, Simon. Boy, I hope I can live up to that billing.
I know you will. By the way, did you ever see Art Carney in that Twilight Zone performance?
Yes, I did, actually. I didn't know the date of it. But that was, well, look, Sterling had so many great episodes of that, and I'll look forward to seeing it on Sci-Fi, and I guess also CBS All Access. You could probably get that on demand as well, I'm going to guess.
You probably can, and I think you may be able to get it on YouTube also. By the way, a couple of factoids about the show. First of all, it was taped 3 weeks before Christmas of 1960. Like I said, it ran the night before Christmas Eve. And just why that episode was made, it was one of six episodes, by the way, that were taped the fall of 1960. You ever wonder why that episode was made?
No. I mean, I wonder. Glad you brought it up. What was the impetus behind it, besides just the holiday season?
Well, according to the Twilight Zone Companion, one of the best books, by the way, to talk about television is by Mark Zuckerberg, which I have at home. Buck Houghton, who was the producer of the Twilight Zone, one of the best, I think, production jobs you'll ever see, he was on it for the first three seasons, said he wanted to do it. Rod Serling wanted to do it because he wanted to see Art Carney play Santa Claus. He just had this inkling of, I got to do this, I got to do this. And he did. And the result is absolutely magical.
You know, it's funny you bring that up. Everybody, of course, thinks, and I just heard the guy who didn't win, we always think of Art Carney and Ed Norton as synonymous. But Carney was so much more than just that one character. And I think sometimes because of the Honeymooners being so iconic, we tend to think that was Art Carney, when in fact it was just a small part of his portfolio.
He was an amazing actor, and of course he also won the Oscar many years later for Harry and Tonto. So anyway,
Harry and Tonto. I remember in a Farrah Fawcett film that didn't do well called Sunburn. I mean, I enjoyed it, but it was one of Fawcett's many films that just did not happen.
So anyway, check out Night of the Meek if you can. If it's on Sci-Fi sometime over New Year's period, I think you'll be well entertained. It's one of the very best Christmas specials of any kind you will ever see. And Art Carney delivers a beautiful performance in a great Rod Serling written classic of The Twilight Zone.
Again, we'll have a revival of The Twilight Zone on CBS All Access. So yet again, we'll see if they have better luck this time around.
What do you think about that? I understand on a number of articles being published in Variety, how they report on the websites this week, this is one of the most anticipated shows of next year. Is that the same thing for you?
I would say, and who's playing the Sterling role? Is it Nick Cannon? I forgot who the host is on this.
Oh, it's Jordan Peele, the executive
Jordan
producer.
Jordan Peele, okay, you're right. You know what? There have been other attempts. And I think the problem is, you would think it would be easier because with all the special effects that Sterling didn't have back in his day, this would be easy to pull off. But I think when you're competing with the quality of the writing and the acting from the 59 to 64 original, it's going to be tough. I just get the feeling audiences then had never seen anything like The Twilight Zone. And to, you know, now that we're 50-some-odd years later, actually closer to 60 years later, I think it's harder to surprise people. We've become kind of a nerd on this. But I am curious to see it. I certainly will give it a fair shake.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of fair shake, what do you think about the world of sports television this year? What really impressed you or did impress you about how the TV side of sports did?
You know, it's funny. I was thinking about some of these streaming services that are now starting to see sports as a way to draw paying customers directly. That's going to be a story to keep an eye on in 2019. For example, DAZN, the Zone, we've seen how they've suddenly came out of nowhere to try to cultivate the boxing and mixed martial arts fan. And to be fair, they've not had the big fights. They just had one this past Saturday night at the Garden, with Canelo Alvarez knocking out Rocky Fielding in the third round. Of course, everyone expected that. Some of us didn't even expect to make it to the third round. I jokingly said that Rocky the Flying Squirrel would have had a better chance against Canelo Alvarez. But, you know, that's, you know, they're banking heavily on guys like Alvarez and Anthony Joshua to bring in fight fans who used to pay. And that may not be a bad strategy, because fight fans used to pay a top dollar for really terrible fights on pay-per-view. The industry, though, got away from that, and to the point where HBO and Showtime, now HBO's out of the boxing game, that's another surprise, but Showtime's had a lot of quality fights on their basic cable, for them basic, not an extra pay-per-view. So this is going to be interesting to see how the DAZN, or the Zone, which is headed by former ESPN CEO John Skipper, how they're going to do. They also got their toe in the water on Major League Baseball, not to show games, but to show a kind of a streaming wraparound show, which in some ways competes with the MLB Network. Now, I don't know how this is going to work. I don't know if it's going to be baseball's answer to the NFL's Red Zone. We're going to have to see how this plays out. So that's an area to keep an eye out on. You and I were at that Bleacher Report live event for the National Lacrosse League last week. And that's going to be kind of interesting when you're talking about paying for niche programming through streaming. You wonder if the market's there to support that. So that's going to be a story to keep an eye out for.
As a matter of fact, so one, I had the takeaway episode of the year on Monday, and I mentioned one of the, I think, the major takeaways this year is that because of smart TV sets and smart TV devices, we now reach critical mass. We are seeing all these original plumbing services that are using these products as the main way to get to viewers, or the way to get to viewers. And one of those areas is sports, ESPN Plus, Bleacher Report, DAZN. And you just raised an example of this, which is that one of the hopes may be that some of these leagues, like the National Lacrosse League and other leagues that are sort of either the second tier of professional leagues or leagues that are coming up like the XFL. I believe there's a league of spring football. We might get to that in a second.
But that's going to be on CBS Sports. Yep. The Alliance for American Football.
And by the way, speaking of sports, you have CBS Sports HQ, which is their spinoff of CBS Sports Network, which is, again, a smart TV service. By the way, how do you think ESPN Plus did this year?
You know, that is, I have to be honest, I just got access to it. And so you picked a good time to ask me on one level. At least I can get a little familiar with the programming. I don't know. They're not going to make that public. But I have to say, I'm impressed more so now after seeing what's on their page as opposed to what I had heard originally. Originally, I thought, oh, you could just watch 30 for 30 documentaries and it'd be a nice little library and maybe some neat sports. But in fact, their content is pretty good. I mean, first of all, 30 for 30 is excellent. But they have some original programming on, like Details, where Peyton Manning, I was just watching this, will watch film of a game, and it's almost like you're in the coach's room. He's a coach, and you're a player on the team as he dissects the plays. It's not just watch the replay. He'll talk about where the footing is, how somebody will drop back, how a quarterback will drop back a half an inch if he sees the quarterback kick his leg back an inch. I mean, it's amazing how microscopic this can get. And again, I would not have known about it. Again, maybe this isn't for everybody, but for those who really take their pro football seriously, This is a revelation. It takes a lot to get me excited, and I can be very cynical. But I was really surprised to see that, how good that was. Another show that I liked was our friend Katie Nolan, who Fox Sports really didn't know what to do with. ESPN knows what they're doing on that either, because they have her on the streaming service doing Always Late. And it's kind of low. It reminds me of the old Uncle Floyd show from 40 years ago. So it's kind of, kind of that low budget, deliberately low budget set. But, you know, it certainly can play up to a cult. And she's very talented. I wish they'd do more with her.
Absolutely.
Not a problem.
And I do remember Uncle Floyd. For those who don't know, it was Channel 68, WBTV.
Floyd Vivino, who's actually gotten to be a national reputation over the years, his brother's a very talented, they're all great musicians. Floyd was like an old school vaudevillian entertainer, for those who don't know, and I definitely urge people to go to YouTube to check him out. But I think his brother Jimmy Vivino was with Conan O'Brien. I know that it's a very talented family.
Right. The basic cable band. By the way, Conan, of course, is now going to the 30-minute format on TBS starting in January. But I want to get to this whole idea of spring football coming back, because I remember the USFL,
sure.
And it was, and actually it had not been for Donald Trump trying to move the league of the fall. We might still have a USFL and a very profitable one at that. Because
I
we're
have no doubt about
another
it,
attempt at this next year, and then the XFL comes to play the following year. What do you think about that?
You know, we're going to see how I think eventually there's going to be a merger between the two, between these two spring football leagues. I think that that's one of the reasons I believe the XFL only started with 8 teams as opposed to rolling out more. And it's funny that I was trying to figure out what markets they went to and didn't go to. I put this in my column. Yeah, obviously they have a New York team at Life Stadium. That's not a surprise. And there's Los Angeles. But surprisingly, they stayed out of Las Vegas, which was really one of their real success stories. And that seems to be on the radar of every sports league right now, where for years, because of the gambling, you know, old school thinking, it seems very provincial now. Las Vegas was a no-no professional league. And the XFL was really the first professional league to put a team there. They're staying out of there. They're staying out of Chicago. And they're staying out of my hometown of Philadelphia. So I don't quite get where they're going with it. But nonetheless, it's to be seen. I like what the Alliance for American Football is doing by putting teams in San Diego, more warm southern and warm weather cities. Also, I got to give a tip of the hat to the XFL. They bypassed Chicago but did put a team in St. Louis. And the reason for that is they have a nice stadium there that has been basically sitting empty since the Rams relocated back to Los Angeles. So that's going to be kind of fun to see how that plays out.
You're hearing Roy Carroll. He is the popular columnist about sports and media and all sorts of other things for the Queens Chronicle. And by the way, for those of you outside Queens or New York, you can catch that online at www.qchron.com. Roy joins me here in the Big Apple. This is our on Smarty Televised. I'm with you live from New York. Glad you were with us on this midweek edition of the program All About Television. Second 3 episodes we're doing this week. If you have a question or comment for Lloyd, ring it in, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, Apple 04 by name. Our final episode of this year will be on December 28th. It's a week from Friday, and joining me will be two people who have observed different aspects of TV and technology. First up, Tony Perkins, the man who made the red herring happen, and he now has a brand venture called Crypto Ventures and Kryptonite. We'll talk about his thoughts about blockchain and cryptocurrency and how that could impact the future of television. And then my final guest for the year will be one of the best people covering the world of advertising, Stuart Elliott, formerly of Media Village, formerly of New York Times. He will be with us. That's all coming up Friday, December 28th, our final episode of 2018, right here on Tomorrow Will Be Televised, 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific. By the way, I understand there's a third spring football league being put together by a number of former NFL stars. Cheddar, The new service that's available on both smart TVs and cable operators, depending on where you are, had one of these players saying that they're going to be putting together a league that will also be going to some of the cities that don't have football right now.
Well, you know what? I just don't – considering we've not had spring football for so long, I just don't know if the marketplace is going to be able to support all these teams. What could happen if – and I think this is probably what that – they're angling for is perhaps having a minor league system, kind of like what the Major League Soccer has, MLS2, kind of a developmental league, or the NBA G League for spring football. I can see where that could be an interesting market concept.
In terms of people on air, play-by-play or color commentary, who do you think did a terrific job this year?
You know, it's funny when I think – I mean, the same faces we see kind of been there doing it a long, long time. I'll tell you who – a friend of mine, he's a Queens guy, I have to admit, maybe a little provincialism here, but Ian Eagle, I think, has really become, you know, a top lister. He's been that for a while, but there's always been – I guess Jim Nance is always going to be above him at CBS, but he is certainly – a guy who could be on everybody's prime play-by-play guy. I think, of course, that big Miami Dolphins game, the miracle in Miami against the Patriots 2 weeks ago. I put in my column that'll be out actually tomorrow, where Ian has probably gotten more attention. That may be his Bobby Thompson, Giants won the pennant call just because of what happened there with social media. I didn't watch the game live, but I certainly was curious to watch that replay to see how they pulled it off. And Ian and Dan Fouts did a terrific job. I think if you ask me what is the most underrated NFL play-by-play team, I think Ian Eagle and Dan Fouts. To me, those are two guys, solid pros. They convey the excitement without overdoing it. They don't need never insult your intelligence. They have a nice, easygoing, unforced banter between them. And so I've always been big fans of that particular team.
I agree, and I thought Ian does a great job on Brooklyn Nets basketball here in the local area on the YES Network, and also he does Thursday Night Football as well, I think, with Dan on Westwood One. So I think he'll be on tomorrow night with one of the latest games, which is now on NFL Network. The Fox deal is done for the rest of the year. I'll tell you, I thought Joe Tessitore, who I've enjoyed on college football for years on ESPN, did a fantastic job this year on Monday Night Football with Jason Witten. He may be the second Dallas Cowboy person in 2 years that has really turned into a talent and in very quick time, and also Booker McFarland. But I thought Tessitore's calls on Monday Night Football games this year has been spectacular and very worthy of an Emmy Award.
And I'm going to be honest, I haven't watched a lot of Monday Night Football, but I've watched Joe Tessitore doing other college games over the years. Well, I think he's a very fine broadcaster. I'm trying to figure out why there's been this backlash against him. Or the whole Monday night team. I mean, again, I don't quite get it, but then again, guys like Joe Buck have been getting that backlash for years, and I think he's extremely talented. I like the fact that he doesn't take the proceedings all that seriously. Perhaps, like, it's like fine wine, you know. Some people love it, some hate it, but I just don't quite understand why, Tessitore has gotten such a harsh reaction from marginal sports fans. I don't get it.
I don't either. I'm very surprised. He comes across very knowledgeable. He knows when to make the moment go. I thought his handling of the game that Drew Brees set his records and was just marvelous. Was marvelous. Just the way you call a game. Who would you say is in the underrated category, or someone who should get more attention?
You know, that is. We have to kind of go through the kind of the. We don't get a lot of it in New York because we generally get the bigger guys here. So it's hard to say. I will say this. There's a sideline reporter who's done a good job. Melanie Collins, who I think this might be her first year with CBS, has done a really good job interviewing Cody. That's a tough job to do. It's you're getting people on the run. She's done a nice job getting the questions out under some tough circumstances. So I would put her in that category of someone to watch for. She could be the next Erin Andrews if you want to look ahead in a few years. If they were the equivalent of stock market for sports personalities, I would invest that way.
Yeah, I'll give you my vote, and it's somebody who I thought should have been on Telemundo's coverage of the World Cup this year, and that's Veronica Contreras, who is their also a sideline reporter on the primetime football games at Telemundo and Universal. By the way, here in New York, she is one of the best local sportscasters in any language. She is the sports anchor on Channel 47, WNJU-TV, the Telemundo's flagship station, and why she was not part of the World Cup coverage on Telemundo nationally is beyond me. She is very good. I see
that's Veronica we're mentioning?
I'm sorry?
Is that Veronica? Is that who we're talking about?
Yes, Veronica Contreras. I think she's fantastic.
Oh, she's great. Yeah, she's done a lot of good work. She's a hard worker, too. I think for a lot of our Anglo listeners, which obviously the vast majority, they probably wouldn't know who she is. But if you've covered sporting events like I have, she's always there. I like to think of her as kind of the Hispanic female Bruce Beck. Hard worker and always there. Again, for those who are not in the local market, Bruce is kind of like Len Berman. These are icons who've been around this market for a long, long time, and they work hard.
Yeah, and Veronica is terrific. She knows how to put a sports cast together. She is cool on camera. I thought that on the Super Bowl coverage this year, she hit the mark in terms of showcasing the young quarterbacks. There were substitutes on their team, including, of course, Nick Foles, who won the game for the Philadelphia Eagles. And I just think she should have been on the World Cup coverage. I cannot believe she was not part of Telemundo's team. And I hate to tell you this, but Telemundo earlier this week released the Women's World Cup anchor team, and she is not on it. Come on, Telemundo. Put Veronica on. She is really sensational, and she deserves, I think, more of a national audience.
I think we're going to have to talk to Senor Griffin down in Miami about this. So she's getting the short straw here. I'm not quite sure why. Because she's worked the big market, and I can attest she is very good.
Yeah. And before we move on, I want to mention a couple of other folks. Brock Ward, who is with Butler Shoes and one of the analysts on ESPN's coverage of college football. I like his work. I think he's grounded. He really focuses on the game and the passion. He has a great, I think, quiet passion. He shows out in this game. I think he and Shoes make a very good college football play-by-play commentary team. And I also got to mention two of my favorites, Gus Johnson and Kevin Harlan. Whenever they are, when it's crunch time in a football or basketball game, leave it to those two. I just think they are the very, very best. I think Harlan's a marvelous job every year on the Super Bowl on Westwood One with Boomer Esiason.
Yeah. No, look, you're talking about some solid pros here. And, you know, we also have to give a shout-out, speaking of somebody who got their start in the New York market, who's gone national. And I can't say he's underrated because he's pretty well-known now because he gets a lot of high-profile events. But Kevin Burkhardt is quickly becoming a gold standard in terms of sports play-by-play and how to conduct yourself as a pro.
I agree. His football work on Fox this year has been terrific. He's a graduate of SNY, Sportsnet New York. And I want to warn people before we move on, Beth Mallins, who is, I think, really establishing herself. I've known her. I've heard her work for years with ESPN. I'm thrilled that CBS now using her on some of the regional football games. She is terrific. She brings a lot to the game. Also, like Veronica, very hard worker and really knows her stuff. Let's, in the time we have left, talk about where you see TV going next year. It seems that we're going to be in for a lot of original programming. You got Netflix, you have Hulu, you have Amazon, and in the mix you're going to have by this time next year, Disney with Disney Plus, Warner Media, Walmart, Apple, who knows who else.
Well, that's the problem here is, you know, we used to talk about it. It's funny, what's the old, the famous Chinese proverb, be careful what you wish for, because sometimes it can come true. And I think we're starting to see that. Look, wasn't that many years ago that we heard, oh, we need to break cable up, a la carte packages, blah, 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 where people can, consumers can say, well, I don't want to watch these channels. I only want these channels. Well, what's happening here is if you want to watch a lot of things, you're going to have to be subscribing to a lot of different services. And I don't – you know, I just wonder if there's going to be – there has to be a shakeout down the road. There's just not – and if the economy turns south, which it could, the market's been shaky. We've been hearing indicators that 2019 could be a rough year. I don't want to get too doomsday here, but it may not be a sanguine year. Well, that's going to be a problem. Disposable income, if that becomes an issue, people have to make choices. And I just don't see all these subscription services being able to survive.
By the way, before we move on, Block 51 is in our chat room. He's wondering, does our show take non-football calls? Well, we are a show, Block 51, about the world of television. That's our thing, and we're focusing on sports television and TV overall. So if you still want to get a call in, do so, 646-652-2906. We'll put the call, question in our chat room, and we'll get it to Lloyd. Anyway, it just seems to me that we are in for a bunch of riches. And I'll tell you, we're going to see a lot of spending on original content, Netflix. The word is they're going to set up with $10 billion on original content next year, maybe as much as $20 billion in 2 years from now. And then you got Apple, you have Amazon, you have Hulu, so you Crackle, Facebook Watch. Of course, the broadcast and cable networks, it seems that everybody is still raising the bar. And it seems the American public with these smart TV sets and devices, they're learning a new way to watch television and use TV.
Well, it's going to be up to us also with so much programming there. It's really up to critics to help viewers out and be able to say, this is worth your time and this is not worth your time. I'll tell you which I was surprised with on streaming services was Tell Me a Story from Kevin Williamson on CBS All Access. It, on one hand, it didn't really live up to from what I've seen where they were trying to bring the old Mother Goose stories like Hansel and Gretel and Little Red Riding Hood and try to make it a modern-day parable. I don't really see that. I mean, they try it, but it seems forced. But on the other hand, I do like the acting, and I like it almost has a Sopranos-like New York grittiness to it. So if you're asking what my favorite kind of appointment viewing has been, I would put that in there, and I put Bill Maher on HBO. His Friday night has become must viewing when he's on. That's I know you can watch on a replay, but that I actually make as appointment viewing.
Yeah, CBS All Access has become a major story because they really turned it up with original programming this year. Tell Me a Story just got renewed for a second season, incidentally. And they only canceled one show, the $1 show. But everything else is still aboard. And like I said, I think Twilight Zone, the revival of that series on Jordan Peele and Monkey Paw, is going to be very, very, very exciting to watch.
Ask you this, Simon. When we used to talk about TV streaming services, it was Hulu and then there was everybody else. Has Hulu lost a little mojo this year when it comes to original content? Besides Handmaid's Tale, is there anything else that you could say, well, this is really must-see TV? Pardon the cliche there, but you get what I'm saying. I just don't see it this year. I could be wrong, but just throwing the question out there.
I think to some degree, yes, but they have had some hits. Castle Rock, I thought was a very good show from Stephen King. The first, the Bull Wollman show, I think that show did not get enough attention from the critics. I think they were looking to see, oh, this is the first Mission to Mars, and they were looking for this like science fiction show, and it really wasn't a science fiction show. As
right.
I think they put, I think that did hurt. The quality of the show is Mark Sharpen, I think, is a terrific performance, and so does the rest of the cast, too. It'll be interesting to see if they do bring that back for a second season. But I'll tell you this, if Disney merges with Fox, Bob Iger is on record, the head of Disney, saying Hulu is going to get a major infusion of original programming. And given the fact that with Disney Fox, you get FX, you get Nat Geographic Channel, you get Fox Searchlight, which formed a TV unit this year, Hulu could become really exciting. And I think they may bring back anime.
Well, doesn't Fox, right? Oh, John, FX have their own streaming service. Are they going to fold that into it? Because again, this is what we're saying. If you can't expect people to be paying for both Hulu and FX now, if there's going to be a lot of overlap.
Yeah, well, they do have Fox Nation, but of course that's part of Fox News Channel, and that's part
right.
of the new Fox that is going to be made when.
Well, it's a separate
entity.
Yeah, that's not going to be under the Disney
separate
umbrella. But I think John Landgraf's FX, which is really given HBO and Showtime a real good run for the money, and they're on basic cable in terms of quality. American Horror Stories for my wife is appointment viewing, so that's going to be interesting to see how the Disney effect on Hulu, as you just mentioned, that may be the kick that Hulu needs, because right now they seem to be a little bit of a malaise, but that could be temporary.
And I heard yesterday about this green card that Steve Burke of Comcast sent to a lot of employees, suggesting that maybe, just maybe, there might be a Comcast challenger to all of this. A year from now, we will see. If you want to find out what Lloyd is up to, here's a very simple way. Here in the New York area, buy the Queen's Chronicle every week, and for the rest of everybody else across the country around the world, here's where you go online to catch Lloyd's work. It's www.qchron.com. www.qchron.com. I promise you, you will be very well rewarded. Lloyd, it's been a pleasure for the past hour. Time flew by very fast. Let's do this again soon, and maybe let's make it an hour.
Simon, I'm there for you. I enjoyed this. It's been a lot of fun, and it's funny. It's been a while since we've done it here on your show. I know we've done things with through Rick Morris, so it's nice to be working on your territory here.
Absolutely, and from us to you, a very, very happy holiday season. All the greatest to you next year.
Thanks. You too, Simon. Talk to you in 2019.
You take care. Lloyd Cowell, the Queen Chronicle, joining us live from New York. Coming up Friday on the Marvel Televised, we will have James Strong from Vanity Fair. We'll have the folks from Engadget talking TV technology now and next year. And from Survivor Kelly on A&E Network, the executive producer, Dream Hampton. Marvel Televised was brought to you today by Audible.com and Amazon Company. Remember, Audible transformed the way you hear the world. For a one-month trial and three free reading books you to check out this holiday season, audibletrial.com/televised. But while we televise, I'm Simon Applebaum in New York. Thank you for listening. Have a great rest of your midweek. We're back on Friday, our regular time, 3 p.m. Eastern Pacific. You know where. Blog Talk Radio Speaker and the iHeartRadio Podcast Network. Whatever you're doing today, please make it safe and make it great. Until next time, stay well and stay tuned.